This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Unless you are one of the 17 million people living there, you probably don't know much about the Mekong Delta. Maybe you have images of the Vietnam War, but that was in another century. Rice comes pouring out of the Mekong Delta, exported all over the world, but that delta is due to become the world's preview of highly populated lands disappearing under rising seas. David Brown is a retired American diplomat and experienced Vietnam expert. He's lived and taught there. David just released a stunning four-part series on the perils of the Delta. It's published at the popular online site Manga Bay. We've reached David at his home in Fresno, California. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, why should we care what happens where the Mekong River meets the sea?
Well, I think you've hinted at it already, Alex, that this is, in a sense, a preview or a dry run for what could happen in a lot of places in the world. Back in 2007, the World Bank released a report where it called the Mekong Delta, along with the Nile Delta and then the Delta in Bangladesh, the Ganges, one of the most vulnerable places in the world to climate change. And that, of course, got the Vietnamese caught their interest. But it's really not until now that they're seriously coming to grips with the implications, the scope and the intensity of the changes that climate change, as well as alterations of the river flow from dam building upstream and from some of their own hydrological engineering in the Delta area, how all of this is combined to create a problem that needs now to be adjusted, find a new strategy that deals with sea level rise, salt infiltration, changing monsoon rain patterns, and alterations to the river flow. So what we've got here is a laboratory that's probably relevant to what we're going to face and we Americans are going to face in South Florida or on the Carolina coast, in the inland delta of California and other low-lying places.
Let's get oriented. Where does the Mekong River start, run, and who are the countries involved in using its waters?
Sure. The Mekong is the 11th longest river in the world, 2,700 miles. It rises in the Tibetan Plateau and flows very rapidly through deep canyons in Yunnan in China, southern China, and then comes down into lower elevations in Laos, Burma, and ultimately Cambodia, and then reaches the South China Sea in the southern part of Vietnam. Comparing it to the Mississippi River system, there's a couple of interesting things here. The average annual discharge of both rivers is approximately equal, but the Mekong watershed is only about a quarter of that of the Mississippi-Missouri system. And there's a huge annual variation in flood according to the seasons. At the height of the annual flood pulse, that's in September, it's about 18 times the flow at the driest point in March and April. So it's hydrologically, it's a remarkable river, actually, because of the variation and because of the way that every year a lot of the river's flow flows into the Great Lake in Cambodia, which functions as a huge aquifer and also something that levels out the seasonal flow and prolongs the floods the time when the crops are in.
And you've been to the Mekong Delta this year, interviewing a lot of people. I was impressed by that. So if we were to go there, just on the Delta, is it all flat grassy lands, or what does it look like?
Well, first, imagine an area about the size of Switzerland, but obviously flat instead of mountainous. Very green in most times of the year in most parts. Very highly engineered. There's a network of dikes and sluices and canals and so forth that's been developed intensively over the last century or so, which controls flooding and directs the water this way and that way. The soils of the Delta are mainly rich and alluvial. They were laid down over the last 6,000 years. But it's in no way can be called a natural environment anymore, but rather an engineered environment, and one in particular has been tuned to produce just about as much rice as possible.
I've seen those bags of rice from Vietnam in local grocery stores, so I know that it's going out all over the world. Now, we will talk about the mega hydro dams that you mentioned and the diversions that threaten the river, but I do want to start with climate threats. You wrote that no delta area, not the mouths of the Ganges, the Nile, or the Mississippi, is more vulnerable than the Mekong estuary to the predictable impacts of climate change. And I found that hard to believe. I always thought it would be in Bangladesh. So this comes as a bit of a surprise to me and perhaps to our listeners. Why is the Mekong the most vulnerable?
Like Bangladesh, the Mekong Delta is heavily populated. About a quarter of Vietnam's total population of 90 million. And the mean elevation above what used to be normal sea level is less than 2 meters. Roughly a third of the delta has an elevation of 1 meter or less. But the biggest vulnerability, from my perspective, is the impact of the decisions made about engineering over the last century or so to control the water. Essentially, particularly since 1975, Vietnam has, as I said, tried to get the maximum amount of rice that can be produced. They have had a kind of a food security, which they call it, almost a neurosis. And food security policy was implemented, perhaps over-implemented, but the decision was to maximize the cropping of so-called miracle rice, which requires that the water level be very strictly controlled. To do that, they had to build dikes which essentially defeated the annual flood pulse of fresh water coming down the river, and instead enabled them to precisely control the amount of rice which got to the paddy at all times of the year. This enabled triple cropping of rice. It enabled Vietnam to produce rice in the order of 25 million tons per year in the last decade or so, of which 8 million tons is exported. But the consequences are very tough on the land itself. They haven't been getting the nutrients that flooding would bring. And a lot of that fresh water that comes down the river goes straight out to sea instead of spreading over the delta and replenishing its own aquifers. So a lot of the discussion on how to build in more resilience to climate change and to mitigate its impact revolves around undoing some of these water control decisions and returning the delta to a more natural state, to emphasizing a much more diverse mixture of crops and vegetables, and in a sense, living with the floods, but getting the benefits. That would enable, among other things, for farmers to spend a lot less money on pesticides and fertilizers if they get the benefit of soap from upriver, as used to be the case. So as I tried to describe in my articles, it's a pretty complicated question, and one in building a consensus among stakeholders on what's the appropriate way to go has been a bit of a challenge.
Well, now, looking at a map, the capital of Vietnam, Hanoi, is at the north end of the country, while the Mekong is in the deep south of Vietnam. Do those divisions and maybe cultural differences continue long after the war, and does that affect how policy might be implemented when we face these challenges?
Well, there are important cultural differences, but I would say that the biggest problems as far as deciding and implementing policy fall into two baskets. One, the country is run by a fairly small elite, the Vietnamese Communist Party, which is secretive. Its decision-making is not transparent. There's been some emphasis on trying to consult more broadly and more openly, but it's pretty slow progress. So that in itself is a problem. There's just not the kind of civil society participation in working through any national issues, not just what to do about climate change in the Delta. The second big challenge from a political machinery perspective is that although, in many respects, Vietnam's a totalitarian state, There are lots of examples where Hanoi has said, this is what's going to happen. And the follow-through at the province or district level is negligible because they're asking for something that the local officials just don't believe in or don't see how that's going to help them.
I'm Alex Smith, talking with our guest David Brown about the Mekong River Delta in Vietnam. Nonprofit groups have warned us that there are problems there, and now we have an excellent article from David about it. You know, occasionally I talk with Indian scientists about climate change, and their preoccupation is the monsoons and then the monsoons. Will a warming world alter these life-giving rains in Vietnam as well?
Alex, it's already evident. I was actually quite impressed by what I heard from scientists in Vietnam when I was there in June, that there's now a fairly consistent pattern with the monsoons are arriving several weeks later than had been the normal pattern. And while there's about as much rain as before, it tends to be a little bit bunchier in September and October, and that itself is a kind of a shock to the equilibrium of the hydrological management.
Okay, well, let's move on to the dams now, and it's a huge subject. I was reading through your article, and my head almost spins just looking at the various proposals and the size of them. What sort of dams have already been constructed on the Mekong?
Well, none up until now in the lower or central Mekong. Upstream in China, in those canyons I mentioned earlier, there's been a lot of dam building. And the Chinese are good at dam building, and they emphasize it. And so they're very keen to export their technology farther down the river. They've got a willing disciple in the Lao government, which is absolutely charmed by the notion of producing enough electricity to become, quote, the battery of Southeast Asia, meaning basically exporting a lot of electricity to Thailand and Malaysia. And so ultimately, over the protests of the Cambodians, as well as the Vietnamese, some years back, the Lao green-lighted the first of a total of seven dams proposed for the Mekong mainstream in Laos. Now, the location is important because about 60% of all the water that arrives in Vietnam is added to the river from rivers in the area of Laos and Burma. And there's already a lot of damming of the tributaries. That's not such a thing, or near as big a problem as the possibility that the annual rainfall could be impounded and then only slowly released by a series of dams along the mainstream of the river. Incidentally, two more dams were proposed in Cambodia. The Cambodians seem to have decided that that's not, that's off the drawing board for them.
So part of the problem you've just mentioned is the fact that instead of an annual flood, which the Vietnamese have learned to control and use, they would just get sort of a steady dribble from these dams. But what about the whole problem of silt and replenishing the soils as well?
Okay. Already, the amount of silt that's reaching the Mekong Delta is about half of the historical average. And that's a huge change. I was talking to a friend, a newspaper reporter in Kanta, the biggest city in the Delta, and he said the story that he'd written, he tries to write stories that will communicate with ordinary people. He said the one that got the most reaction was one which featured pictures of the river flowing clear blue instead of murky brown in June. And it's not supposed to happen. The river is supposed to be full of silt. So this was a kind of a striking paradox. And my friend said that's, according to fishermen he's talked to, that's pretty much the way things have become. Most of the attention that's been given to the dams on the Mekong has been the predictable impact on the world's most prolific inland fisheries by interfering with fish migration, and that's a very big concern also. But for the Vietnamese, the real problem is the change in the overall volume of water, the pattern of its arrival in the Delta, and the fact that it's not going to be carrying anything like the amount of silt and other nutrients that used to be normal.
Who would finance these mega dams, David Brown? Is the World Bank involved?
That, of course, was pretty common in the old days, but the multinational banks have pretty much gotten away entirely from financing large dams like this, as understanding of the side effects, the potential adverse consequences of these big dams is more broadly understood. So if the dams are built, financing is going to have to come almost entirely, I think, from Chinese banks through the new through China's new Asian Infrastructure Bank. And there's some speculation now that probably all the ones that are projected will not be built because of the difficulty of trying to predict what the markets for electricity will be like in 15 or 20 years from now.
And then, incredibly, Thailand has announced plans to divert water out of the Mekong River. What do the Thais want to do, and is it correct that they've already tried it a little bit?
They've experimented this summer with a kind of a scale model of a rather ambitious plan to pipe water from the Mekong, or actually from the mouth of a very small tributary of the Mekong, through the mountains and into the basins of a couple of rivers in Thailand's northeast area, which is typically fairly arid, potentially diverting a fairly large fraction of the river's flow. And I'm not persuaded they're going to go through with this plan. It may have just been, if you will, talk from the government in response to the fact that Thailand, like Vietnam last winter, was experiencing the worst drought in many, many years, in Vietnam 90 years, and the government needed to be seen to be doing something.
Yes, that drought, I did read about that. Now, Lester Brown was the founder of both World Watch and the Earth Policy Institute, and he often warned that rice was already near or at the top of its temperature tolerance. And I've seen other studies suggesting if the global mean temperatures go up a degree, rice production goes down by at least 10%. What have you heard about this?
You're right that rice doesn't tolerate increased temperatures all that well. No crop does. Although I haven't seen numbers as apocalyptic as the ones you mentioned. But there's something else at work here, and that's the fact that through breeding it's possible to, over time, to both come up with varieties of rice which have more tolerance to salt infiltration, and potentially also can withstand, have strains that can withstand higher temperatures. All of this without any genetic modification whatsoever, but simply breeding experiments at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is David Brown, a retired American diplomat who then became an educator in Vietnam. His latest article at mongabay.com warns us about a developing climate disaster in the Mekong River Delta. David, the scientists I talk with are pretty certain we will get at least 1 meter of sea level rise globally by the end of this century. Of course, it will vary in certain parts of the world. Your article in Manga Bay suggests that could force the migration of between 3 and 5 million people out of the Mekong Delta. Can Vietnam cope?
Okay, a change in the population of the Delta on that scope actually would not be such a horrible thing. Every country in the world, as it develops, has produced more and more farm crops with fewer and fewer people, while others move into services and industry and so forth. And that's been happening in Vietnam since the 1990s, when the Vietnamese gave up on doctrinaire socialism and adopted a essentially capitalist economy. So there's been a fair amount of migration from the Delta already to the industrial zones around Ho Chi Minh City, what used to be Saigon. And the farmers have become more efficient. Buffalo have been replaced by small tractors, and a lot of the heavy labor that people used to have to do has now also been mechanized, so that extra labor is really only needed in the harvest season, And in fact, there's a lot of people who don't have land, who are just sort of scraping through, who might find better opportunities elsewhere.
Interesting. Okay. Well, now, the government of Vietnam must be making plans to deal with the impacts of climate change. What have you heard about that?
I think we can say that the government, certainly the stakeholders, are talking about what can be done in a serious way. A few years ago, the ministries of agriculture and of the environment and natural resources began some very serious discussions with the facilitation of the Dutch. And the Dutch have had a very active, rather effective development assistance program in Vietnam for some time. And, of course, they do know something about managing delta areas and holding back the sea. Well, it's been a fairly, quite a productive exercise as far as first bringing together two ministries which are usually trading insults and getting them to work cooperatively. And secondly, once a general plan was worked out, vetting this with stakeholders, including farmers, including agro-industry, and, of course, the folks in the universities and who know something about the changes in store for the Delta. And after a lot of discussion, it was now, I guess, 2013 that this plan was presented to the government. That was December of 2013. But time passed, and there was a political change at the top. It's only now, according to my friends, that the government seems to be actively discussing what can and ought to be done. And there's an expectation that there will be a kind of a first hearing of what is proposed by the National Assembly in its session, which starts at the end of this month. Shall I talk, Alex, about the contents of the Mekong Delta Plan, which the government is considering?
I would like to hear it, yes.
Okay. Essentially, you recall there's been a big problem with salt infiltration. And last year, it was going inland up to 100 kilometers, halfway across the delta. Now, this was certainly a wake-up call for a lot of folks. And it certainly made the notion of a slow strategic retreat kind of sound very sensible. The idea is that instead of trying to grow rice and other crops which require fresh water in the coastal areas, they'll be allowed to become brackish, essentially given over to shrimp aquaculture and other activities which make good use of salty water. And in efforts to increase the retention of fresh water in natural aquifers farther up the river, diversifying crops, breeding, as I mentioned earlier, for salt tolerance, and generally adjusting to or adapting to climate change rather than trying to resist it by building dam after dam. Now, for that to happen requires basically a big change in orientation by the Ministry of Agriculture, and it's not yet entirely clear to me that they're on board. But I think one of the most important reasons why the rest of the world ought to keep an eye on Vietnam is to find out how, when you get down to questions which involve social change, really well-thought-out, no-regrets, economic planning and other things, is whether a government, almost any government, is able to, in fact, exercise this kind of experiment in long-range planning, in the full knowledge that whatever is done is only going to slow down and delay the inevitable. There's, to my understanding, scientists expect that sea level rise is not going to stop at 1 meter, although it may reach there by 2100. But, you know, it's clear that in Vietnam and other places, the notion of planning, adaptive planning, is going to have to go on a rolling basis. And as the Dutch experts emphasized, trying to avoid doing stupid stuff, not investing a lot in plans which are bound only to maybe only delay the inevitable, but in fact truly adapting.
In that way, Vietnam is almost like a workshop for the world, and it's so unfair because the people of Vietnam have contributed so little to the atmospheric pollution. I mean, we are the people who have polluted the atmosphere, but they're the people who are going to have to adapt and then keep on adapting for centuries. As we finish up, I get the feeling that Vietnam is almost like your second home, like an adopted relative. How did you get there, David, and why does it continue to matter to you?
Well, you know, I finished college in 1964, Alec, and joined the American Foreign Service. I was very young, very idealistic. I was sent out to work at the embassy in Vietnam. Spent a lot of time going around and trying to find out what people were thinking and write coherent reports about that. But I arrived in Vietnam an idealist, and like many others of my generation, I went home a cynic. But I never lost my fascination for the country and the charm and the beauty. Its charm, its beauty, its wonderful food. There's a great deal to like about Vietnam. And so when I had an opportunity after my retirement from the State Department to lead up an environmental education project in Ha Lam Bay in North Vietnam, working with kids, local high school, college kids, in helping them to understand how man's activities, both tourism on the bay and industrial development on its margins, were gradually killing it, its economic value. Well, I jumped at the opportunity to do that. Did that for 3 years, spent another couple of years in Hanoi, and it reached the point in my ability to read and understand Vietnamese that it was kind of a natural that when my wife and I returned to the U.S. To basically put down our roots again, that I began to write about it.
We've been talking with David Brown. He's retired from the American Diplomatic Service. He's lived and taught in Hanoi, as you've heard, and doing environmental education as well. His work has been published by most of the major journals and periodicals covering East Asia. It's a long list. And I'm recommending his four-part illustrated article on the Mekong Delta. The first of those was published October 3rd, 2016, with the title, Will Climate Change Sink the Mekong Delta? Find that at mongabay.com or look for all the links in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for talking with us, David.
Alex, it's been my pleasure indeed.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.